from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Judy Campbell in for Michael Krasny. Judy Melnick has made a career of working with dead bodies. As a forensic pathologist working in medical examiner's offices, she has probed and prodded bodies for clues that may reveal murder, suicide, a medical accident, or a rare genetic disease. In her book, Working Stiff, Melnick chronicles her two rookie years working in the New York Medical Examiner's Office, a job she started 2 months before the 9/11 attacks. Melnick, now based in San Francisco, joins us to talk about a career straddling medicine and law. That's next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio, welcome back to Forum. I'm Judy Campbell in for Michael Krasny. Whenever forensic pathologist Judy Melnick starts to tell a story, her husband warns, remember, this can only end badly. Melnick deals with the dead and the stories their bodies tell. She specifically deals with those who died sudden, unexpected, or violent deaths. Melnick is an associate clinical professor at UCSF Medical School. She's worked in the San Francisco Medical Examiner's Office. And her new book, Working Stiff, 2 years, 262 Bodies and the Making of a Medical Examiner, chronicles her early days in the profession working in New York City. Welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks for being here. Well, it's a fortuitous time to have you here, especially with the tragic death of Robin Williams recently from suicide. And suicide is something that you have dealt with a lot in your office. And one thing that has come up today is there have been articles criticizing. There's the way that this has been reported and the graphic nature of the reporting, details about Robin Williams' suicide, how he did it, the position he was in, et cetera. Do you think, what do you think of criticisms of too much information coming out on stories like this?
I think the information is crucial for the coroner or the medical examiner, in this case it's the Marin coroner, to investigate and document, because that documentation is an important part of the investigation into the death. The decision about whether that's going to be put in the press is really an ethical decision for the press, and ultimately they have to measure the public's need to know with the consequent effects on the family. And the reaction of people to saying that it's too graphic is an indication that there are some things that are better left in the public record, but not necessarily on the radio.
Well, you often deal with how to talk about the details of a death. You, maybe more than people realize, deal with family members of the people who have died. You're often the person explaining what happened and how.
Any time that someone dies in a sudden and unexpected way, and suicide is one of them, the deaths come to the coroner's office and we will decide whether or not an autopsy is warranted. And in many cases, suicide for families is a hard thing to accept. There's a lot of denial and there's a lot of suspicion, especially if the family hasn't been in close contact with the individual before the death. So there sometimes is suspicion laid on the boyfriend or girlfriend who found their body. And so then it's my job to talk to the family over the phone, explain the physical findings, and explain why the death is not from foul play, but is from a self-inflicted act.
And how do you decide how much detail to give? Do people want to know? Do you suss out whether they want to know and what you tell them?
I don't voluntarily call the families. I mean, in many cases, they will call us, and usually because somebody at the funeral parlor has raised a suspicion, or they heard some story through the gossip mill about something that the person had done, or they just can't accept it. And they say, he was so hopeful, he didn't leave a note, there's no way. And so in those circumstances, I have to give them some details about how the body was found, what the position the body was in, the indications at the scene that this was a self-inflicted act, whether it's the way the shoes were lined up and the way the door was locked and secured so that there's no way anybody could have done this to the person. They must have had to do it to themselves.
Now, suicide is a very personal issue for you. Your father committed suicide when you were...
I was 13. I was 13 years old, and at the time, I was aware that he was depressed. I suspect that he had bipolar disorder and was not diagnosed.
And he was a psychiatrist.
He was a psychiatrist, and he was seeing
a psychiatrist. So he knew how to diagnose.
Exactly, and of all people in the world who should have sought help or should have recognized that he needed help, this man should have sought help. And yet he was seeing a psychiatrist. He hadn't been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, though I suspect that that's what he had. And he committed suicide in the same way Robin Williams did, by hanging himself.
You have said that there are two ways that survivors of suicide approach it. There are those who talk and those who don't, and you make it a point to talk about it.
I believe in talking about it because I think that in many ways, suicide now is similar to what cancer and AIDS were like 10, 15 years ago. We used to not talk about cancer. It was referred to as the C word, and people would whisper about AIDS or come up with alternate ways that people died instead of admitting that their loved one had HIV. At the time when the AIDS epidemic was starting, really becoming prominent in the 70s, people didn't recognize how prevalent it was because of the silence. And the movement to promote it and talk about it actually had posters that said silence equals death, because there was a recognition that by keeping silent, we aided in spreading the disease. And so as famous people started to come down with HIV and become more open about it, AIDS no longer became a stigma. And I think that the same thing is true for mental illness, but especially for suicide. I think we can't just talk about this being an end stage of mental illness, because to some degree it is preventable. It's not the inevitable or inexorable result of all mental illness to commit suicide. We can prevent it, and there are known and documented preventative efforts. So we have to talk about it, because that's how we prevent it. We prevent it by talking about it.
And people have said, even just recently in reaction to Robin Williams, that talking about it, especially talking about methods and how it's done and what are effective ways that it's done, can be dangerous, that they can cause copycat suicides.
That's a very good point. So there actually is a website and an organization called the American Association of Suicidology, and you can look them up on www.suicidology.org. And they have media guidelines for how to discuss suicide and guidelines for physicians and information for nurses and practitioners and even just lay people who might have a depressed friend to give them advice on what questions to ask, how to frame them, and how to get help.
Now, from you going through this experience, what did you when you were a kid and you were dealing with officials, you were dealing with people, you know, who were informing you of your dad's suicide? What did you want to know? What did you not know that you wish somebody told you?
I was more upset about the fact that I wasn't allowed to talk about it. So it was, I knew because my mom told me anything I wanted to know and answered all my questions. She was very open with me. But then when it came to talking about it to other family members, and especially to my dad's parents who were still alive at the time, they had been told he had a heart attack. We weren't allowed to discuss it. That was verboten. So I found very difficult, the fact that I went to my family and we were there for the funeral, but the one thing we couldn't discuss was how he died.
When you talk to family members of people whose autopsies you've done, when it's a suicide, you tell them about your story sometimes.
It depends. I mean, it depends how upset they are or how much in denial they are in. In many cases, they've never heard of anyone committing suicide. They've never talked to a suicide survivor before. Whatever their social circle or religious circle is, it may not be something that has been openly discussed. So by opening up to them and telling them that this happened to me and I was 13 years old at the time, And in many cases, if they have kids, I will tell them, these were the questions that I had when I was 13. So you might want to open up that discussion with your kids. One of the things that I was concerned about was that it was somehow genetic, that suicide was genetic. And this is kind of an absurd idea, but for a 13-year-old, it made sense. And it gave me comfort to be told that, no, suicide is not genetic. You don't catch it through your genes.
And another question that seems to come up is people trying to make sense of it. You say
it doesn't make sense, and it's never going to make sense. And I'm 45 years old now, many years later, it still doesn't make sense. And that's part of what makes it a suicide, is unless you yourself are suicidal, you're not going to get it. You won't understand it. It only makes sense to someone who is suicidal, who is in that frame of mind.
So you deal with a lot of these. Sometimes you are distinguishing whether this is a homicide, whether it's a suicide. Are those hard to tell often if something is a suicide or if it's an accident or a murder?
In the majority of cases are pretty straightforward. And the thing I should also say is suicide, just like homicide, is a minority of what we see. The majority of what forensic pathologists investigate are natural deaths and accidents, people who die in their house or in the street, and nobody knows why. Sometimes they're not even identified. So it's a real head scratcher. There's no medical history, there's no ID, and you have to start from scratch trying to figure out who the person is, what their medical history is, and then by doing the autopsy, figure out why they died.
And those are the cases you like. You like the mysteries. The homicides get all the attention, but the mysteries are the ones you like.
Well, that's what I say in Working Stiff. A bullet goes in, a bullet goes out. There's no mystery there if it's a straightforward homicide. The most challenging cases for me are actually the medical mysteries, the one where the person goes to the hospital and has surgery, and even the doctors can't figure out why they died. So then the stakes are much higher because I have to be the final decider and the final opinion. And sometimes there's civil litigation, like medical malpractice, that comes from that.
Right. Now, you talk about medical malpractice. You have seen some pretty tough stories. I wonder if you can talk. There was one case that you talk about a case that you ended up ruling a homicide. It was of a doctor performing abortions.
It was a woman who had basically been in a vegetative state for a long period of time. And when I tried to figure out why she was in a vegetative state, I found out that it was an abortion that was botched many years before. She had been in a clinic where the doctor was doing back-to-back abortions. I think they were every 10 or 11 minutes, even according to his own notes. The medications were outdated. The anesthesiologist wasn't certified. And there was an investigation. He ended up having medical restrictions placed on his license. And given the degree of negligence there, I felt that this was a homicide, and the chief medical examiner concurred.
I wonder, you talked about the sort of puzzle of some of these cases, and there's a story that I found very interesting. It's I think her name is Mary Lynch. I wonder if you could tell that story, things that seem straightforward and maybe aren't.
So these are the kind of cases that become a lot more complex. In Mary Lynch's case, she was found at the bottom of the stairs in her apartment building by her husband. And at the initial examination, it seemed like a straightforward fall down the stairs in a woman who liked to drink. But when I found out that he wasn't supposed to be in her apartment, in fact, he had a separate apartment and they'd been estranged for years, and there was a lot of suspicion raised by her friends about their relationship and about how violent he could potentially be, I wanted the case investigated as a homicide, especially given that I found grab marks on her arm.
Right. Now, this was an interesting story because you didn't see anything on her body that suggested that there was foul play, but then you waited.
Right. So the point of that story, the teaching point that I got from it, was that whenever there's a death that's suspicious, it's a good idea to hold the body for 24 to 48 hours, because during the process of performing the autopsy, the blood actually drains down the autopsy table. So when you die, blood will settle on your back according to gravity, and that's called lividity. But during the autopsy, the blood will drain, and now you can see injury on the back that you didn't see before. So the injury was there, but it was being obscured by the passive gravitation of blood. And now you can see it the next day.
And I would like to give a disclaimer here that we are talking about this book contains graphic descriptions, and our discussion may not be suitable for all listeners. We are talking about the body and death. You have some pretty gruesome stories in this book, gruesome stories sort of about what happens to the body in decomposition, the state of bodies that come to you. You also have horrible murders and suicides, though, as you say, not the majority of what you deal with. But you say you're not a ghoulish person. You're pretty sunny. You're an optimist.
I'm a real Pollyanna, actually. I was as shocked as anybody would be when they're seeing this for the first time. In fact, when I described the first body I saw that was massively decomposed, I was nauseated. I had to go outside and get some fresh air. So in writing the book, I was documenting my first impressions, just like any layperson who is interested in the field but doesn't know about the details. And I try to be very matter-of-fact in my writing about it. I don't try to dress it up or use euphemisms.
Oh, you do not. Hey, there's a part you talk about. Let's see. You say, learning to handle human beings who've begun to return to the soil cycle has, more than any other aspect of the job, made me more comfortable with death, though it's also made me much, much less comfortable with houseflies and leery of cats.
Yes.
You want to explain that?
Well, for one thing, once you have houseflies buzzing around your morgue and you've got the maggots on the body, I don't like flies much and I really can't abide them near my food. And then on top of that, I've always been a dog person. I have to say I'm kind of biased towards dogs. But I have seen a disproportionate number of people who have been eaten by their pet cat, but
they turn on them fast,
but not the dogs. The dogs will sit by you and starve.
Well, how has this affected your view of death and life? You see horrible accidents. You see unexpected things happening to people. You have three small kids. You were, during the period of this book, you had a toddler. Does it just make you want to not let your kid out of the house?
Just the opposite, actually. I think I'm probably more liberal parent than most just because I know what really kills people. So for one thing, when my kids start to do something that might be potentially dangerous, I do have a lot of street cred when I say, hey, stop that. I know someone who died that way. They will actually listen to me. But I do know that it has kind of released me from the typical nightly news phobias, because staying alive, as I say in the book, is mostly common sense. You got to look both ways before you cross the street, wear your seatbelt, don't smoke, get exercise. These are pretty easy things to follow.
Deaths that you see, a lot of heart disease.
Heart disease is the number one killer in this country, and mostly it's related to obesity and people who don't take care of their bodies.
You started your job in New York in July of 2001. So looming over the book is what we know is coming for somebody in the medical examiner's office. Talk about the morning of September 11th.
It was the most beautiful morning. The sun was out. The sky was blue. I was walking into work and I saw this plane flying over my shoulder really low. And like anybody else who'd see a plane flying a little abnormally low, I just kind of normalized it. And I thought, oh, it's probably an early approach to the airport or something like that. And I went into the building. And when I put my keys down and got my stuff together, one of my colleagues came in and told me that on the news they had reported that the plane had crashed into the building. And at the time, the initial reports, they didn't even know whether it was a passenger jet. It was possibly a small plane. We're not certain. And I knew it was a passenger jet. And I knew from seeing it that it was terrorism right there. So we waited until the bodies arrived. The bodies started arriving in the evening. I think it was around 6 o'clock.
And it took a long time. They were checking the bodies for explosives? Is that?
Because people didn't know what it was, there was a delay until the bodies came to the office to make sure that they wouldn't be a danger for us. And initially, it was just setting up the morgue and getting the operations to the point where we could handle the identification efforts from 9/11 in conjunction with the routine cases that came in every day. So while the book primarily focuses on my routine cases, in the meanwhile, throughout the entire time, we were also working the line, as we called it, identifying the deceased from 9/11.
And that must have been very difficult work.
It was hard work, and it was overwhelming, even to the pathologists who had experience. I was inexperienced. I only had 2 months of training when this happened, and it was by the grace and by the teaching of the chief medical examiner and all the staff that we supported each other and did what we needed to do.
And your task then was different than it usually is. You were not interested in how anyone died. You knew. You were identifying people, which was very hard.
It was different because, like you said, in most of my cases, for one thing, I would be tasked with the cause and the manner of death. In this case, we knew the cause. It was multiple traumatic injuries. We knew the manner. It was a homicide. All of them were classified as homicides. But the issue was, who is this person and how can we give closure to the family and bring them back to their family so that they can be buried or cremated or whatever the family had decided. The other difference also was that in my routine cases, I would speak to the families on a regular basis. But for practical purposes, they had social workers and health professionals communicating with the families and getting the identifying information that we needed in order to make a match. So while we were working on the 9/11 identifications, I didn't have direct contact with those families. It was only later.
Right, right. And how did that it changed you doing the 9/11 work?
I write in the book that it really affected me as it did everybody who did that job. We all share a bond that includes the firefighters and the people who worked on the pile. We all share a bond that I don't think anyone understands except another person who worked that job.
I think in another case, family members of someone you had worked on, you know, asks, how do you do what you do? Why do you do this horrible work? And What's kind of your response to how you do this?
First of all, it's the training. I mean, many years of training add up into being able to objectify the bodies sufficiently to be able to do your job, but still respect them. And more importantly, you need something to get you to get back to work every day. And that's the people who are waiting for answers, because the deceased individuals are not my only patients. The families are the ones who need closure. They're the ones who need to get medical information that may have pertinence to them in terms of answering questions for their family about their genetic history or about their medical history, but they also want closure. They want to be able to grieve and move on.
And when people ask you if their loved one suffered, do you tell them?
It's a very difficult question to get because back when I wrote the book and I was honest about my assessment back then, I did lie to some people because I didn't know how to answer it. I've learned since then that I can't lie. And the reason is because everything I do, as I discussed earlier, is public record. My reports, my documentation, all of that's discoverable. It can go to court. If I get called to testify in court on pain and suffering, I'm under oath. I can't lie. So if I say one thing to a family member in order to give them comfort and something else in court, they're going to find out.
We'll continue our conversation with forensic pathologist Judy Melnick, author of Working Stiff, 2 years, 262 Bodies, and the Making of a Medical Examiner, after a short break. If you'd like to join the program, give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your comments to forum@kqed.org. I'm Judy Campbell. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Judy Campbell. We're talking with Judy Melanick, forensic pathologist and associate clinical professor at UCSF Medical School. She's author of the new book, Working Stiff, 2 Years, 262 Bodies, and the Making of a Medical Examiner. She has an appearance tomorrow at Green Apple Books in San Francisco at 7 p.m. On Sunday, she'll be at Barnes & Noble in Corte Madera at 5, and she'll be at Book Passage, Corte Madera on August 27th at 7 p.m. Now, this is a book that you wrote with your husband.
Yes. He's the English major. I'm the doctor. I still have been practicing medicine since then. So after my fellowship training, I was in Santa Clara County for a year, and I worked in the San Francisco Medical Examiner's Office for 9 years. So I was continuing to do this while my notes basically sat on an electronic shelf, the equivalent of a shelf for 10 years, until we finally decided to collaborate and work on it together.
Well, it's funny getting both you and your husband's voice in this, because you are, you know, you're obsessed with the body. You want to know the medical oddities. You want to know what's going on. And he wants to know, did the person go to prison? Did this case get solved? You mark something a homicide. Did anybody ever charge it? You have different approaches.
He's my sounding board, and he keeps me normal. He also makes me realize sometimes that there are greater answers that forensics can't always answer. And like I said, the television shows tend to portray that everything's a homicide, everything gets wrapped up in 45 minutes, and that we know all the answers. And I think what I portray in the book is that we don't always know all the answers. We don't always get all the information. And some things are going to be mysteries, and some things will be left unsolved.
Well, you met the TV shows. Forensic pathologists are hot on TV. They have been for a while now. What do you think when you see those shows?
I can't watch them. I end up yelling at the television.
Why is that?
TJ has to shut it off. I actually wrote a blog post about it. It's called 7 CSI Fails, where I list 7 things that drive me crazy about the TV shows. They include things like the fact that these folks are constantly in the dark. They're working in—
Yeah, what is that? Why is it always dark? And they're wearing like headlamps, even in the lab.
It makes no sense to me. We turn on the lights. When I walk into someone's house and they've been murdered, I'm going to turn on the lights. I will make sure I have gloves on so I don't contaminate the scene, which is the other thing that they do. They don't wear their personal protective gear on television at all. I think it's because producers of the show want the actors to emote. And for some reason, if they have a mask on their face and a face shield, you're not going to be able to see their expressions. So that's why that decision is made, for aesthetic reasons, but it's not accurate. And you can't go and do an autopsy without protecting yourself so you don't catch disease.
Right, right. The heels as well,
yes.
Right?
Well, first of all,
you do not work in stilettos.
I do not. I've gotten called out to crime scenes at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I just get an address, and I don't know where it's going to be. It might be a talus slope in a park where a body's been dumped, or it could be down in the marina where it's uneven and there are piers and there are little slats. So I wear sensible shoes. Sometimes I just wear sneakers.
We have an email from Mary who writes, "A friend of mine died very suddenly 5 years ago, and I suspect that the medical examiner in her very small town and the small town police miss the indicators of foul play. How much of the time do you think there are deaths that are actually homicides that are erroneously ruled as death by natural causes? My friend was very healthy and not yet 55 years old. I cannot let go of my suspicions. If you were trying to re-examine a case where somebody died 4 or 5 years ago, where would you start?"
I get these calls actually quite frequently because I'm also a forensic consultant. So I will have family members or in some cases attorneys call me and say, "We have this case and these are the suspicious things about it. Can you review the autopsy report and let me know?" So with regards to the person who wrote this, if you have concerns about the way your friend died or what the cause of death is, the first thing you can do is you can actually request the autopsy report. There's nothing private about an autopsy report. You can get one for your neighbor. You can get one from Marilyn Monroe. They're public records. And there's a reason that they are public records, because when someone dies suddenly and unexpectedly, there is a civic need to know in order to prevent further deaths, whether it's from foul play or from an infectious disease, a public health hazard.
You have had very contentious relationships with some police. I was very surprised in the book at how much you investigate the stories behind the bodies. You're saying you're not just doing the autopsy, you're not just looking to the bodies for clues, but you pick up the phone, you've interviewed people, you get very involved in the case, even if you don't see it coming to you as a homicide.
That's when I'm supposed to investigate. So when it's a homicide, it is the police's job to investigate. But if it's an accident or a suicide, or if it's undetermined, it's not clear, we have to do the investigation. It's our job to try to figure out what it is. As soon as we determine that something is a homicide, then we hand it over to the police, and it's their job to figure out the circumstances and the whodunit. In many cases, I'll know something is a homicide, but I won't know who killed the person. I just know that they were strangled or they were stabbed. And then it's the police's job to canvass the scene, talk to witnesses, track people down, and figure out the whodunit part.
Well, you told the story of Andres Garcia. I wonder if you could talk a little about that. It was a horrible case. It was tortured. There was an anti-gay slur written, I think, in blood on the wall. And talk about, you know, kind of what you saw in that case and what you dealt with the police officer.
These cases are very difficult for the police because in that case, I don't think he had any lead on it being anything. He had no idea who killed this person. And given the circumstances, it's understandable that it's easier for the police perspective for something to be called either undetermined or a suicide because then they don't have to investigate it anymore. When I call something a homicide, they have work to do. It's like me saying, here's your work now. You figure it out. And like
so
I said,
there's reluctance.
It's especially when you don't have any idea. The police, in my experience, are wonderful in the majority of cases. I've had wonderful experience with police officers, both in New York, in San Francisco, and now I'm in Alameda County, and I've had a fantastic experience working there. In general, they are very diligent and want to figure things out and will listen to the pathologist. It's in their best interest. But the cases in the book are from 12 years ago, mm-hmm. and at the time, I was still learning. So getting pushback from the police when they don't want you to call it a homicide was something I was experiencing for the first time.
How do you find it different in San Francisco and New York? Crime different in San Francisco and New York? You seeing different kinds of cases?
In San Francisco and Alameda County, I've seen pretty much the same spectrum. It's funny because I've been asked, oh, what you do is very unusual, and actually what I do is very mundane to me. I'm not doing anything different than forensic pathologists are doing all over the country. We get different percentages of homicides versus accidents depending on how fast the speeds are in your city versus in a more rural or in a suburban environment. They tend to get more motor vehicles, for instance. But on the whole, this is the same spectrum. As long as the demographics are the same, you're going to have the same amount of crime.
Michael from Oakland joins us. Hi, Michael.
Hi. So as a resident of Alameda County, I'm really pleased to hear that we have medical examiners that are actually forensic pathologists. NPR did a really eye-opening series, I want to say a couple of years ago now, at the state of medical examination all across the United States. And first off, how many medical examiners or coroners were employees either of the police department or of the DA and were therefore subject to all kinds of conflict of interest that it sounds like your guest is very courageous about giving pushback on. And also, yeah, how many places the coroner is an elected official who isn't necessarily have any background in forensic pathology, doesn't even necessarily have to be a doctor. We had, when I lived in Pennsylvania, we had an election between a long-experienced, well-respected professor of pathology at a medical school who was the incumbent versus his, you know, partisan rival from the opposite political party who was perhaps better looking than the incumbent, but was an emergency room doc. And, you know, not to say he wasn't competent as a physician, but, you know, you want someone who is not getting elected on the basis of partisan considerations, who is not an employee of the district attorney and therefore subject to pressure from them, and who actually knows how to look at dead bodies and determine what kills them. So I'm delighted for the fact that apparently we have competent representation here, but wow, it's a scary situation across this country.
Right. Thanks for calling, Michael.
I do want to respond to that because I think that one thing that people have a misunderstanding about is they don't understand the difference between a medical examiner and a coroner system.
Right.
And a medical examiner system is one that's run by physicians and where the chief medical examiner has to be a board-certified forensic pathologist. Coroner systems are run by law enforcement or administrators. They can hire pathologists to do the autopsies, but the determination, the final determination of the manner and cause of death is up to the coroner. So it's really a question of whether they hire board certified staff or not. And in the United States, we only have about 500 board certified forensic pathologists. That's about half of what we need to do all the forensic autopsies. And people are not going into this field. You'd think it was really popular from watching television, but it is not. And we have a hard time getting people to go into the field.
Why is that, do you think? I mean, you started off, you originally wanted to be a surgeon, and you just found that residency almost killed you.
It did. And I went into pathology but didn't have the passion for it that I had for surgery until I found forensics. One of the reasons we don't have students going into forensics, despite the TV shows, is that it's a really long haul. You have to go through 4 years of college, 4 years of medical school, 4 years of anatomic pathology, or at the minimum 3 years of anatomic pathology residency training, and then you need to do the extra year. The fourth year would be your fellowship. So by the time you finished and you're ready to practice, you're already, you know, in your late 20s, early 30s, and you've now officially started work. Most of the jobs are going to be county or government jobs. They're going to pay less than had you just done hospital pathology in the first place. So it's the one of the few specialties in medicine where by doing extra training, you end up actually getting paid less.
And also, I mean, there's just people get excited about saving lives or, you know, helping people live better lives when they go into medicine. It's kind of a U-turn, maybe it feels like, to go into that profession, go all through med school and then work with dead people.
And yet you can still save lives as a forensic pathologist. Any pathologist who's identified the cherry red color of carbon monoxide poisoning and can warn people to get that place tested, or has identified an electrocution hazard and has gotten the electric company to address it so that nobody else gets killed, knows what it feels like to save lives.
All right. We are talking with forensic pathologist Judy Melanick, author of Working Stiff. If you'd like to join the program, give us a call, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can send your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. Lindsay, join us. Hi.
Hi there. I find this topic both fascinating and personal, obviously. I was wondering if I could ask for a comment, insight or comment or opinion on the current kind of shift in, obviously in previous generations, there was at-home death and therefore home burials, keeping the body at home basically with the family and not using, you know, the coroner's office, et cetera. And I find that there is now kind of an uprising, a bit of a shift going back toward that direction in regard to families who have passed away. And I was wondering if you had any opinions on that and or could comment on the legality of that or families' rights in that regard.
Any thoughts on that?
So if I understand your question correctly, you're talking primarily about burial practices and the disposition of the body after the death or after the coroner's investigations? Is that what you're asking?
Or bypassing altogether the investigation.
Well, the thing is that not every death gets reported to the coroner's office.
Right.
So if somebody dies of a natural death in a hospital or even at home that they're known to be dying of a natural disease, then it's really up to the family and whatever funeral arrangements they want to arrange, whatever is comfortable for them, for their religion or their cultural practice. The deaths that get investigated by the coroner's office are ones that are sudden and violent or unexpected, and like I said, there's a civic need to know, those bodies do get returned to the families or the funeral home after the autopsy is done.
Now, what can how is it decided? I mean, you talked about one way that, autopsies are done. Can anybody request an autopsy if they want one?
If the death is natural and at a hospital and there's a doctor who's willing to sign a death certificate, those deaths can be autopsied at the hospital. There's a pathology department in most university hospitals, and there are also local pathologists who can do work as autopsy pathologists or consultants, but they won't be part of the medical examiner's office. If there's any suspicion of foul play, if the family is somehow concerned that they weren't cared for properly, then it is appropriate to refer cases like that to the medical examiner or coroner's office. Now, they may decline jurisdiction and say, we're not interested. It appears to be a natural death. And then they can get an autopsy done by a private practitioner.
Right. Ken in San Jose writes, a few years ago in Los Angeles, there was a case in which opening the body cavity caused many people in the room to be sickened, and I think it might have even caused a death or two. Was it ever finally determined what the cause of that was? Have you heard of this case?
I have heard about the case. I don't remember what the final result was. I don't think that it was ever really elucidated, and there was a concern that there was some sort of chemical that the patient had been taken as part of their therapy that was playing a role in it. But without having reviewed it, I can't say for certain.
I mean, is that something? Are there dangers when you're conducting these autopsies?
That's a great question because, again, like I said, they don't have personal protective gear on television.
Right.
So there are dangers in performing this procedure. Just like in any medical procedure, there are blood-borne pathogens. We can be exposed to AIDS, to HIV, to hepatitis C, hepatitis B. So we will wear gear. And if there's a case that is particularly concerning as an infectious disease hazard, there are suits that are called – they're self-contained apparatuses where the air is circulated internally, and you can do an autopsy covered in that. It's technically more difficult because you're sweating underneath it, but it can be done in order to figure out why the person died but not expose the staff to the hazards.
Well, has that been an issue with Ebola now? Are those...
It would be if the – my understanding is we only have two patients in the United States right now, and they haven't died yet. But if they were to pass away, then that decision would be made by the local jurisdiction about whether an autopsy even needed to be done. Again, we do it when we don't know why they died. If the person's still alive and we can collect specimens from the body when they're still alive to diagnose the cause of death, there may not be a need for an autopsy after death.
And you actually were one of the few doctors who has seen you were present for an anthrax autopsy shortly after September 11th, a woman in New York who died of anthrax.
So there was an inhalational anthrax case. And in that case, even though we knew that it was anthrax from the hospitalization, the reason an autopsy was necessary is to figure out the method. How had she been exposed? Because that case, again, was a homicide. So there are legal consequences to our determination. Did she get it from the skin? Did she get it from the GI tract? Or did she get it by breathing in spores? And the autopsy examination showed that the lungs were primarily affected, not the other organs. So it suggested that it was an airborne exposure.
Now, in the medical examiner's office you were working at in New York, the policy was that all, I think, substance abuse deaths were autopsied. Why is it? So anyone with a history of substance abuse, is that what the policy was, and why was that?
The policy was the default was to autopsy anyone who had a substance abuse history, specifically because they die disproportionately of accidents. So they can – a person who has a substance abuse history, either injection drug use or even alcohol use, can damage their liver. And by damaging your liver, your clotting factors don't work. So even a minor trauma like a trip or fall that superficially would leave no sign of injury on the body can cause massive internal bleeding from a ruptured varix, which is an enlarged blood vessel, or bleeding on the brain called a subdural, and you would never know it. You'd see the person dead, they look pristine, and then when you open them up, you find devastating internal injury.
So the idea here is that you could have had foul play. Something could have been going on, and it would have been, you know, a fight or something that maybe wouldn't have killed somebody who wasn't kind of physically compromised in that way.
Correct. And these were also difficult homicides for the police to investigate, because if a man was in a bar fight and then walked away and went home and collapsed at home of bleeding in the brain, where the initial impact occurred an hour prior in the bar, we find him dead much later, and we don't know about that initial altercation. And if we find out about it later, then we may call it a homicide.
And how do you find out? I mean, if you look at the body, that is something you can tell.
It is to some degree, but sometimes you can't. And you need to have what we call a reasonable degree of medical certainty. If I'm going to call something a homicide, I want to be damn sure I can get on the stand and testify, not just to reasonable certainty, but in many cases, to beyond a reasonable doubt. Because when you're prosecuting someone, that's the standard that they're going to be held to.
You're in this interesting year, medicine and law. I mean, you kind of have a foot in both. You're trained in medicine and kind of law. It sounds like you sort of learn that on the job.
You do. You don't learn law in medical school. And the forensics aspect, the reason it's called forensic is it has to do with the law. So learning how to answer questions, especially how to simplify the science without dumbing it down, is an important aspect of what we do, especially when we're testifying in court.
Timothy in San Jose, join us. Hi.
Yes, in some foreign jurisdictions, they have the coroner's jury of an inquest. Colonial America had that procedure. I believe some of the early American states had it. Does it still exist in the United States? Do any jurisdictions use the coroner's jury of inquest? And is it a criminal procedure? Or what's your opinion on that method?
That's a good question. There are jurisdictions that still use the inquest. The coroner has subpoena power and can subpoena people to come and testify if they don't want to. So I have been aware of there are jurisdictions in the United States that still use it. Ultimately, my inquest is the same thing as my inquiry when I call up family members or the girlfriend of the deceased or whoever last saw them alive and ask them questions about the circumstances surrounding the death so I can help figure out what happened. That inquest may not happen officially in a jury room under oath, but I can still come to the same conclusions. And the whole purpose of the inquest is to decide the cause and the manner of death. It's not a criminal proceeding. It's essentially a civil proceeding. And then if the determination is homicide, then it gets passed on to the district attorney who makes the decision about whether to prosecute.
Often you don't know what ends up happening with these cases, huh? I mean, it seems like one harrowing case after the other in your book. You say, I don't know if anyone ever followed up on this, if anyone ever went to prison.
And sometimes I find out about it years later, which is also the criminal justice system is very slow. And there have been some cases where I've spoken to family members. And even though we knew it's a homicide and we knew who was responsible, I warned them up front, this is going to take a long time because the court system is slow. And until you finally get satisfaction, it may be many years from now. We're going to have a very long relationship. And there are some family members who continue to call me and send me notes even to this day based on these prolonged relationships that have developed just because of the randomness that their loved one died and I did the autopsy.
Yeah. I mean, talking about things taking a long time, sometimes you have cases of people who have been dead a really long time. There was one unidentified guy 15 years later. I think they were looking for him. I mean, you know, there was information about identifying him and you recover the body and have to do an autopsy on the body. How much information can you get from a body that old?
When a body is skeletonized, ultimately all you can tell is what's in the bones. So the soft tissue is gone. The more decomposed a body becomes, the more it restricts or limits your ability to say sometimes what the cause and even the manner of death is. And then that's where it's imperative that the pathologist is aware of the limitations of the science and conveys that.
Here's an email from Cherry who writes, I used to work for the medical examiner's office when that official was Boyd Stevens, a respected pathologist who worked on AIDS prevention in the bathhouses. I heard recently that the San Francisco medical examiner's office has hundreds of cases that have not been signed off on. How can this be? I also heard the office is lacking pathologists. True. And now you were in the San Francisco medical examiner's office until last year. And there has been there's been a lot of trouble in that office.
That office, from what I saw over the 9 years that I was there, had been slowly starved of resources over the course of many years. So people had left. There was an understaffing of the investigative division, of the administrative division. And even myself as a doctor doing work there, I was doing a lot of technical work. So I being working, in addition to being a doctor, I was also processing evidence, doing photography, taking x-rays like an x-ray tech. So eventually I decided to leave. And one of the frustrations I had was that it would take so long for me to get my results. And I was getting frustrated getting on the phone with families. And many would call me and say, why don't we have the results back yet? And I would say, I don't have an answer for you. Ultimately, it's the responsibility of the local government to fund and maintain the office. And I believe that they're trying to turn things around now, but their problems that they're having is that they cannot find forensic pathologists to fill the positions. There aren't enough around. Well, and also, once an office already has a backlog of hundreds of cases, anybody who comes in there is going to need additional resources. You can't just replace the chief medical examiner. You need to replace the technical staff, the administrative staff, all the losses that that office has had over the course of many years.
And meanwhile, there are all these families out there, people frustrated who aren't getting answers.
It is very frustrating for them. And working in a civic capacity as a public servant, it can be very frustrating when you want to give people answers and you don't have the resources. I know what that feels like.
John asks, do you witness the change in a body from life to death? Do you believe there's soul or a spirit?
I believe that whether you want to call it a soul or consciousness, that's gone by the time I get the body. They're already declared dead. And really my job is to try to give an answer to the people who still have spirit, which is their families. So I have witnessed very few people actually transition from living to dead. That experience was more during my surgical and medical training. I can't speak to religious matters because for that I would refer you to your religious practitioner. But from the perspective of a forensic pathologist, I respect the bodies tremendously, and I know that they're there to teach us something. I don't think that the autopsy procedure itself disrespects the body. Just the opposite. It's there to answer questions and give closure.
Judy Melnick is forensics pathologist and associate clinical professor at UCSF Medical School, author of Working Stiff, 2 years, 262 Bodies, and the Making of a Medical Examiner. Thanks so much for being part of our program. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Judy Campbell. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.